From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So they built this enormous dome, which looks like it's on the scale of the pyramids. This enormous plutonium dome, which remains there, of course. They plan to have it there for many thousands of years, with plutonium in it. And the whole island also is still covered with plutonium. They didn't clean up the island of Runnett. They left it as it is. And you just wonder, I mean, this is the greatest monument to the 20th century.
Looking for trouble, one woman, six wars, and a revolution. Today, a conversation with 60 Minutes producer Leslie Coburn. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Canadian Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, has made his first trip to Cuba. The Cuban president, Fidel Castro, greeted Canada's prime minister with a searing attack on another country, the United States, suggesting war crimes trials for what he called the Holocaust of the U.S. embargo of his nation. Chrétien arrived in Cuba yesterday and has devoted much of his time to discussing U.S.-Cuban relations. It's the first time in 24 years that a Canadian leader is visiting Cuba. Chrétien is one of the most important Western leaders in years to visit Cuba, adding to a series of Cuban victories over U.S. efforts to isolate the island nation. Canada and Cuba have had uninterrupted diplomatic relations since 1945, and Canada has long been critical of Washington's blockade. Opposition calls for a boycott of Nigeria's parliamentary elections apparently were successful. Voter turnout figures were not expected from the government, but officials said privately the number of people going to the polls may have been the lowest for any election since Nigeria gained independence in 1960. Analysts had said the turnout would be a key test of support for military ruler Sani Abacha's plan to govern as a civilian. Emboldened by the low turnout, Abacha opponents scheduled a national day of protest for May 1st to demand his ouster. A Tibetan activist was critically injured after setting himself on fire in New Delhi today in protest against police efforts to halt a hunger strike. This according to Tibetan youth Congress workers. They said Thubten Ngodup, who is 50 years old, suffered 90% burns. He set himself on fire at about the same time police hauled away to a hospital three Tibetans after their hunger strike entered its 48th day. Yesterday, police took to hospital three other hunger strikers who'd been protesting against Chinese occupation of Tibet. An Indonesian student activist said today he was beaten and subjected to electric shocks after being seized at gunpoint by three men in Jakarta in early February and held for 2 months. Pius Lasterlanggang, who's 30 years old, speaking at the offices of the government-backed National Human Rights Commission, said he'd be threatened with death if he told of his ordeal. The Indonesian armed forces should take responsibility for this, he said, without directly identifying those who had kidnapped him. East Timor's resistance movements have united to elect jailed guerrilla leader Xanana Gusmao as leader of a new single front against Indonesian rule of East Timor. At a historic four-day convention that ended early today in Lisbon, Portugal, the resistance also chose a political committee and drew up a draft charter for the eventual independence of East Timor. Germany's media today expressed horror at the prospect of extreme right-wing politicians taking seats in an eastern state parliament after scoring best regional far-right results since World War II. The German People's Union, known as the DVU, which has been accused of anti-Semitism and racism, took 12.9% of the vote in the economically depressed state of Saxony-Anhalt yesterday, this according to official provisional results. This news from the United States, the Clinton administration is slowing the payment of Medicare claims submitted by doctors, hospital, and other health care providers. This according to a report in the New York Times today. The government has also ordered insurance companies that review and pay Medicare claims on behalf of the government to send fewer notices to beneficiaries and to make greater use of telephone voicemail to answer inquiries from doctors checking the status of unpaid claims. This again according to the Times, citing federal officials and government documents. Two-thirds of the Senate called for a vote on a proposal to restore food stamp benefits to, quote, legal immigrant families. The bill, which also reauthorizes agricultural research programs, would overturn a provision of the 1996 welfare reform law. The White House says it would veto the legislation if it did not include the food stamp provision. A Justice Department study has found 13% of male prisoners and nearly half the female prisoners at local jails have been sexually or physically abused at least once in their lives. The more than 3,000 U.S. jails house more than 500,000 prisoners by mid-1997, a rise of 43% from mid-1989. And finally, an explosion damaged a Catholic-owned bar in Northern Ireland late on Saturday night, but there were no casualties, the police said. Violence has persisted despite a peace accord signed this month. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Leslie Coburn, who is currently a producer at 60 Minutes. She's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and has produced and directed dozens of documentaries covering wars for CBS and ABC News. She was also a correspondent for PBS's Frontline, has won numerous awards, and now has written a book about her life called Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Leslie.
Thank you.
Well, why don't we start with the first war you covered, the Contra War in Nicaragua.
Yes, that was really obviously a very important war to me because it was the first time I'd seen really the horror, and it was the first time that I'd seen what U.S. foreign policy can do. And it convinced me to continue on and to do that, which I've done now again and again and again in various places. But with the Contra War, one of the first pieces I did on that war, which was for CBS, was called The Dirty War. And it was about the absolutely horrendous tactics used by the Contras, terror tactics in the hills of Nicaragua. And I traipsed around Nicaragua at a time when there were whole zones that were cordoned off. You weren't supposed to be in those zones. We went there to see what was actually going on and came back with a pretty awful report that got the State Department very, very upset. They even put up a dartboard with my name on it.
How do you know?
Because I was told that by a State Department person who was throwing some of the darts. But the Contra War was, as I say, it was certainly a watershed for my reporting, and it convinced me of the importance of being a witness and of going out to the front to see what's going on, both not staying at home and not staying in the hotel once you get there.
In addition to throwing the darts, didn't the State Department also try to get you fired at CBS?
Yes, they did. Elliot Abrams, who was an important figure in those days in the State Department to do with Latin America, he, after the report that was titled The Dirty War that went on the air that showed what the Contras were doing up in the hills, he then tried to convince the president of CBS News at the time to fire me and to fire the people I was working with at the time. But fortunately, the person that he was going to bring in to say how awful we really were was one of our best sources. And so the deal didn't go through, and we had been tipped off about it, so we could do something at our end and make sure it didn't happen so no one was fired. But there was a blacklist at the State Department at the time.
You write in your book that in 1986 you made a call from CBS to the White House National Security Council asking for a colonel named Oliver North to confirm or deny that the White House was running a covert operation not authorized by Congress to sustain the Contra War in Central America. What did he say?
Well, you've got the exact quote right there, I think. But he said this is absolute nonsense and ridiculous, basically.
I've learned over time that when an official responds ridiculous or absurd and tries to totally marginalize you, you are probably on the right track.
Absolutely. It's the complete tip-off. We knew that we were heading down the right direction. But it was a good lesson. I don't talk a lot about the whole Iran-Contra business in this war because I wrote a book about it called Out of Control. But I think that it was a very good lesson in how you can really find out what's going on in the field when people in Washington are dissembling, and all you have to do is get on a plane and go there, and you're going to meet someone at a coffee shop who's going to tell you the whole story of what's actually going on. That happened in Central America, and it's happened elsewhere, I think.
the Contra War has come back to haunt many in this country, and people are now reminded of it by the series that Gary Webb did in the San Jose Mercury News a while ago. He no longer is a reporter, came under a lot of attack and pressure for the series where he wrote about the Dark Alliance, the idea that the Central Intelligence Agency did not look the other way, but actually supported Contra drug runners who got drugs into this country and funneled them into the black community of Los Angeles. What did you think of that series?
Well, I did not. I actually haven't read the web series word for word, so I shouldn't comment on it specifically. But I do think, I mean, as you probably know, I did a huge amount of work on that area years ago. And I was astonished, really, by the uproar over the web series in a way, because it had already come out in Senate hearings that the CIA had supported a whole group of people who were working with the Contras, who were ferrying goods in and out, and you know the whole support system around the Contra War had a number of very well-known drug traffickers in it, and the Senate took the CIA to task.
This Massachusetts Senator Kerry?
Yes, with a voluminous report. So how you could suddenly get upset now and say, I think probably what happened was the web series took it one step further and said that there was, you know, pointed out that it was going into poor neighborhoods in L.A. So it's making the obvious connection. But certainly, I think, interestingly enough, I was hearing, I haven't read the full CIA report on this, the most recent one. However, I hear that the executive summary says not much went on. But however, the report itself has some very interesting details about what the money was for and where the money went and how money was returned to perhaps one of these people who was involved in that case. I think that there is no question. I mean, I knew Enrique Bermudez. I knew these people. And there is no question that they were dealing with drug traffickers. The other thing that's amazing to me is, of course, when I was looking into this, when the government finally admitted that the leader of Panama was, in fact, a drug trafficker, I would have thought that at that point we would have all accepted that the CIA was in bed with drug traffickers. I mean, here you had a guy who was earning more on the CIA payroll than the President of the United States was earning.
Is that true?
Yes, and yet at the same time, I mean,
Manuel Noriega.
Yes. So Noriega, who's now in jail as a drug trafficker and who we invaded his country to sort out that problem, I mean, he had been on the payroll. So it just seems to me that all of that sort of came out years ago, and now it's being rediscovered.
I knew he was on the payroll. I didn't quite know that he was making more than the President of the United States,
yeah,
at least a salary. You mentioned one U.S.-backed dictator, Manuel Noriega. Another one that you covered was Baby Doc Duvalier in Haiti, and you were in Haiti when his regime ended. Can you talk about that?
Yes, that was very interesting because I wanted to I went down there. This was for CBS, and I wanted to do the story of what had actually happened in the revolution, the Haitian Revolution, which was very interesting because it was a time when the priests, the Catholic priests, actually joined forces with the Ungans, the voodoo priests, in that uprising. And so I wanted to do that story. But while I was there, and the Tonton Macoute, the henchman of the Duvalier regime, had sort of melted away into the forest. These guys, when I arrived, they had necklaces around their necks. They were being killed in the streets for these terrible crimes that the Macoutes had committed. But they'd sort of vanished. But then there was suddenly this other force that was in Port-au-Prince called the Leopards, the Leopard. And we saw them operating, and these guys were really cruel and vicious, and it seemed to me that they were absolutely replacing the Macoutes. So I dropped the other story to look at who they were and who had supplied these people and how they got there, and it turned out that they, in fact, were covertly supplied by the United States, and we found tracked down the suppliers and found the whole route and how it was done.
How did you find out?
Well, I had a very good team working with me, and I'd gotten a tip-off in Port-au-Prince, in Haiti, about the company called Aerotrade that had done this. And then Ty West, who was working with me, who was in New York, immediately started working on the U.S. side to find the company, to find the guy who ran the company and get him to talk on camera, which he did. So it was simply a matter of diligence.
Why do people talk? Why did he talk?
No one had ever come to talk to him before. He was quite happy to talk about it. He was very proud of what he'd done. It was interesting. He described arming this force down to their toothbrushes and their underwear. But then he also described how, on camera, he said, but these people are now being used to terrorize the people down there. That's not what we trained them for. And he then went in to describe how they were being used like the Makuts, which we were actually seeing on camera. So we were able to marry the two, what he was saying in the pictures.
Now, he was a U.S. businessman.
Yes.
What was his relation, or was there one, with the U.S. government?
Well, he was an arms contractor. There are many of these. That's in the netherworld of the arms business. People who will be a contractor for a certain job, for the agency, or because when the CIA, or in the case of the Contra War, the State Department, when they need things done, they go around to establish contractors, and many of whom are in southern Florida, as this man was.
Leslie Coburn is our guest. Her book is Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. What was the revolution?
The revolution, I suppose you could say, too, because I talk about Iran as well, but the revolution I was talking about was Haiti, because, in fact, when Baby Doc left, people didn't really appreciate how much of a revolution it was. There was a sense that he had just fled the country, and, in fact, there had been this tremendous groundswell, and I talk about it a little bit in the book on how things started in Gonaïves, which was the traditional hotbed of revolution in Haiti, where things had started in the early 19th century.
It's interesting because there is a priest there, Père Daniel, who continues in Gonaïves to fight for justice in Haiti. And the thing they have been calling for more than anything now is justice, you know, against the many coup killers of those 3 years and back to when you were there in Baby Doc Duvalier's time and afterwards. And yet the U.S. government has refused to return the 160,000 documents they got from FRAP and Haitian military headquarters that would enable them to start to pinpoint who these people are.
Well, I fear that it's very embarrassing for Washington because of their close relationship with some of these people who are clearly killers. I mean, people who were contract intelligence agents and all these things have come out. I mean, there's been such good reporting on Haiti, and yet when the truth comes out about who these people are and their associations, nothing gets done. I think it's a tragic situation.
How are you able to do the kinds of investigations you do? We hear more and more in commercial news and the news divisions. I mean, you have ABC now run by Disney, which does business in Haiti, paying its workers something like, 28 cents an hour. How can you get any honest news out through the commercial networks?
Well, I think it's more and more difficult. I think that unquestionably you're seeing more and more tablet television, which means that people like me who are trying to do these kinds of investigations, they're just fewer and fewer places. I'm very lucky at the moment because 60 Minutes is a haven for this kind of thing. You can still do a proper, straightforward investigation and put it on the air. But a lot of these shows, they really don't want to know. I mean, I told one story in there where Primetime Live asked me in the fall of 1996 to go. I was thrilled. They asked me to go to Afghanistan to look into the Taliban regime who were behaving so badly against the women of Afghanistan. And this was Diane Sawyer wanted to do this. So off we went. But it only happened because she wanted to do that. And the last big story they'd put on the air was about garage door openers. And that's the usual story.
Leslie, I want to talk about the Taliban because they're in the midst of peace negotiations right now. But first, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Our guest is Leslie Coburn. Her latest book, Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. She'll be back with us in a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! ¶¶ You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Taliban Religious Army and its northern-based opponents returned to the negotiating table yesterday to try to bring peace to war-racked Afghanistan. After 5 hours of talks yesterday in neighboring Pakistan, the two sides agreed to try to stop any major offensives against each other. We'll continue to cover this issue, but right now we are joined by Leslie Coburn, who has written the book Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. Leslie, you were just about to talk about your trip to Afghanistan with Diane Sawyer. In fact, you were covered when you were there covering this story.
Yes, I'd been into Afghanistan not that long before, in 1993, at a time when the situation, you have to understand that the people who were warring factions in Afghanistan all were in the pay of the U.S. government. These were all of the fundamentalist groups who were fighting the Russians. And suddenly, after that war, after the Russians withdrew, they started fighting each other. And in fact, it kept huge arsenals of weapons, which they then were using on each other. I was there at one point with John Hockenberry. We did a story after the World Trade Center bombing, where one of the people involved in that had trained in Afghanistan. So we went back to Afghanistan to talk to the people there. And rockets were falling at a rate of one a minute. It was hundreds of people were dying in Kabul. Kabul now looks like Hiroshima. So those were the kinds of conditions that allowed this very shady group called the Taliban to walk across Afghanistan, take over Kabul. They pretend to be, more religious than anyone else. In fact, many of them are not terribly well-schooled in the Quran. But they came in and they took over Kabul, and there are some truly extraordinary women in Afghanistan who, during many years of war, ran the city. They ran Kabul. They all the professors, the best surgeons in the hospital, all these jobs were held down by women. Many of their husbands were dead. So suddenly the Taliban came in and said to these women, "You must go home. You can't work. You must be veiled head to toe with what's called a burqa, where you can only see out through a screen. It's very hot, the material. It's very uncomfortable."
In fact, there's a picture. Is that of you on the cover with one of those?
Yes, I'm wearing one of those on the cover.
I mean, that is serious. That you don't have any open space.
No open space. You can't see, when you're... You can really only see straight ahead of you. You can't see much to the left or right. And the Taliban not only did that, they then said women not only have to wear this in public, but they can't wear noisy shoes. Their shoes are too noisy. They can't wear shoes that make a sound on the sidewalk. They also said that music was not allowed by the Quran, and this is their interpretation. So they were, in fact, killing songbirds and also destroying all videos, slashing all paintings. And the Taliban are still there. The situation has not gone away. But that's what we went to cover. And their reaction to us was, how shall I say, we're treated slightly differently because we're kind of, from another planet, being these women marching in from the United States. They were sort of disgusted by us, I think is a good word. These are people who are just not the sort of people I can really understand. I think it's a gross injustice, and I think that because they were mainly going after the women, for a long time people talked about them as though they were acceptable, as though they were just village boys, and you have to understand this is the way they behave. In fact, that's not the way Afghan village boys behave. These are guys who came out of the old... They were camp babies. They were raised in the refugee camps, trained and educated by the Saudis. And the whole operation of them moving in was run by the Pakistanis with money from the U.S. government. So,
and that's so often a story that we don't hear. I mean, you mentioned doing the piece with John Hockenberry, looking at the World Trade Center back to Afghanistan, this idea of blow back, the idea of the U.S. training groups of people, and then suddenly when they come to haunt the U.S., talking about them as terrorists. But these are terrorists that they have trained.
Exactly. That story that John and I did was very important because we broke the story that some 10,000 Arab Mujahideen had been trained in Afghanistan. I talked to many people who had been literally, you know, whisked away from a mosque in Saudi Arabia.
When you say Arab, you're making a distinction between Arab and Afghani.
Correct. These were people who were foreigners who had been culled from the mosques in Cairo, in Algiers, in Mecca. You know, a lot of people came straight from Saudi Arabia. People had gone to Saudi Arabia to be educated. We're told, you know, go to Afghanistan. This is the jihad. And in fact, the Saudi government was working with the U.S. on this and was very keen for them to go. And they were acting as, in many cases, as couriers. They were bringing in arms, bringing in supplies, doing the jobs that the CIA did not want to do directly. But this force that was trained in training camps by the U.S. Then, of course, wanted to carry on their jihad. And when the war was over against the Russians, suddenly everyone disappeared. But they, because they believed so much in this jihad, had been trained for it, said, well, I'm going to take this jihad home. I'll go back to Cairo and fight my jihad. I'll go back to Saudi Arabia. So you see them now. Many of these people in Algeria, they're known in Algeria as the Afghanis, these people who were trained in Afghanistan and in Upper Egypt as well.
You also talked about, just in the adventure part of your story in Afghanistan with Diane Sawyer, how you smuggled videotapes out under your burqas.
Yes, that's right, because the government, the Taliban government, was insisting that we show the tapes. You know, any tapes had to be reviewed. And I was simply not going to go through a review process. But then we were going out on a very tiny UN plane, and the UN didn't want us to carry the cassettes. So actually, we just strapped them. I mean, at the airport, we went into this back corridor and stuffed these cassettes, you know, in our underwear, and we're suddenly much fatter. But we figured that no one would pat us down, but I was terrified that a tape was going to end up on the floor and then we would be discovered.
In 1980, you covered the U.S. war games in preparation for World War III at Hitler's former command post in Heidelberg. And you did a CBS documentary called The Nuclear Battlefield, which resulted in Germany demanding the removal of thousands of U.S. tactical nukes from German soil. Can you explain what this is about, World War III?
Well, of course, at the time, there was this very intricate system of, I mean, you know, the nuclear theologians spent a great deal of time thinking about how we were going to fight and win a nuclear war. And part of all that was that the troops in Europe, which we would think of as conventional troops, I mean, guys with tanks and mortars, all had nuclear weapons out in the battlefield, tiny nuclear weapons down to the size of nuclear landmines. And the nuclear battlefield was about those people and those weapons and what they intended to do with them. And the correspondent on that hour was Harry Reisner. And I remember an extraordinary moment when he was interviewing the general in the Pentagon who was in charge of this program. And he said, and they'd been talking about how they were going to fight this nuclear war in Germany. And he said, General, with all the moving around on the battlefield, how do you avoid hitting your own troops? He's talking about with nuclear weapons. And the general said, well, Harry, that's a real problem. What we discovered and what we put on the air was that the second you start having a war like that with small tactical nuclear weapons, very quickly all of Germany, and I mean West Germany, would have been destroyed. So the Germans got very upset about this, and they showed the film many times in Germany and began to agitate for the removal of these weapons.
Speaking of things nuclear, you traveled to a small island in the South Pacific declared off-limits by the United States Army for 24,000 years?
That's right. Out in the middle of the Pacific, there's an island called Run It. And I went there because the U.S. Army announced that they were going to clean up the Inuvituk Atoll, where so many of the nuclear tests had been conducted. And all those islands, of course, were dusted with plutonium, which lasts for, you know, the half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years. And so they had this plan, and they were taking all the plutonium with bulldozers. You know, one speck of plutonium in your lungs can kill you. They were going after it with bulldozers and picking up huge piles of this stuff and dumping it all on the island of Runnet. So they built this enormous dome, which looks like it's on the scale of the pyramids, this enormous plutonium dome, which remains there, of course. They plan to have it there for many thousands of years, with plutonium in it. And the whole island also is still covered with plutonium. They didn't clean up the island of Runnet. They left it as it is. And you just wonder, I mean, this is the greatest monument to the 20th century, the plutonium dome of Runnet.
How did you get there?
By U.S. transport from the island of Kwajalein. Kwajalein is the base in Micronesia where all the missiles, when they do testing for intercontinental ballistic missiles for World War III, all the missiles would go from Vandenberg to this beautiful lagoon of Kwajalein. So it was a big military base, and we flew from there by transport, military transport, I think it was a C-130, up to Kwajalein, and then went out to the outer islands by helicopter.
Why did you want to go there? I mean, didn't you get contaminated yourself?
Well, I wanted to go there because I think that the whole issue of plutonium and this kind of contamination, the situation of those islanders, is one of the most important issues of our time. We went to see a group of islanders who had been forced to leave their island at the time of the testing, and they were being told now by people who arrived from Washington that they could go back to their island. And in that meeting, they were told that their island had been cleaned up. But of course, there was still strontium and cesium, stuff that is in the soil and that grows up in the coconuts. And this was being explained to them, and the people from Washington were talking in terms of rads, which is a unit of measurement of radiation. And this went on for some time. And finally, the spokesman for the local people said, "Excuse me, how big is a rad? Is it as big as a rock?" That the communication between the two had been two sides had been non-existent, and yet these people were going back to their home. So I thought that it was an important thing to cover.
But what about your own contamination?
Well, when I was on the island of Runnet, all of us who were there, because there was a camera crew and Morley Safer was there, and we all wore suits, contamination suits. Unlike some of the boys who were operating the bulldozers, who simply had surgical masks on, but because the weather was 130 degrees, I actually saw some of them take their masks off while they were driving bulldozers pushing plutonium. But we had masks on. We had boots on. So we were in good shape, though I think that if we had... I knew that it would be classified if it turned out that we had very high levels of radiation. It would be classified. We would never be told.
We've talked about Haiti and the U.S. dictator, U.S.-backed dictator, Baby Doc Duvalier, the dirty war you covered, the Contras supported by the United States, this testing, the nuclear testing that has been done by the United States in the South Pacific, going so far as to declaring a small island off limits for 24,000 years. How does it leave you feeling about the United States, your country?
Well, I think that, this is a great country. It's a huge country. There are all sorts of people in it. I think that what it tells me is that if you don't have a watchdog for the government, then people will sometimes go out of control. I think when you have a country like the U.S., which is the most powerful country in the world, you have people sitting in back quarters in Langley, Virginia, or whatever, who will come up with remarkable stuff. And it's the more I look at all of these things, the more I see how important it is for there to be a press, to be reporters who actually are trying to keep an eye on things as much as you possibly can. And that is our job, and if you don't, things will go haywire.
Do you think it's increasingly less possible in the corporate press? I mean, you had, for example, Fair's expose of 2020, where they said where the executive producer was married to the spokesperson for the nuclear industry, so he would accept no nuclear stories, of course. Well, your network now, CBS, owned by Westinghouse, NBC, owned by General Electric, the makers of most of the weapons in this country and that go out around the world. How is it possible to do these kind of investigations these days?
Well, I think you can always find cases now. I mean, there are many, many cases of people not being able to do stories. I have not had the experience myself of being told, certainly, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned CBS. I think that 60 Minutes is very much left alone. They don't get that kind of pressure. I think that in some other programs, I don't know. You'd have to take it case by case. But I think that I think we should all be worried about it. I think that there are fewer and fewer places. And who knows? You know, at 60 Minutes, everyone's getting old. And what happens what happens 10 years down the road? Do you have other people stepping in and doing that quality journalism or not? Do you have them doing something about more garage door openers?
Or celebrities. I mean, that is now everywhere in these so-called news magazines. It's these celebrity stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's very distressing for me. I've never done a celebrity story. To me, that's not news. I mean, but what will happen if you do, if suddenly it's all celebrity stories, then we will be in the position of what you often see in third world dictatorships, where you open the paper in the morning and it's designed to give you a happy breakfast, where there just is no news at all.
And celebrity stories do more than that, I think, because people don't identify with celebrities. They really are sort of superhuman. They really disempower people, even when it's a story about, say, drugs in a celebrity or some crisis that they've gone through. People feel that they are not like them and that there's nothing, increasingly there's nothing we can do about anything.
I think that's true. I mean, I certainly don't identify with them. And I'm interested looking at my children, seeing how they react to celebrities and the whole celebrity culture. I mean, I'm very much trying to keep them focused on thinking about things that they can do and places where they can excel.
Speaking of your children, you've had three of them through this quite amazing career. How did you do it with raising three kids?
Well, I was very conscious at the time when my first child, Chloe, she's now 18 years old, so she's grown. But when I was pregnant with Chloe, I was very conscious that I was expected to leave. I was expected, the normal thing would have been for me to say, well, this has all been fun and now I'm finished with my career. I just didn't want to do that. And so I really pushed myself to the limit, I have to say, in terms of I worked while I was pregnant. Fortunately, I was very lucky because I had pregnancies where I didn't have a lot of complications. But I was on the road with all of them. In fact, 5 years ago, I was on the road with Charlie, my youngest. I went to Somalia 6 months pregnant. And that was before the U.S. forces went in. So it was at a time when Somalia was being billed as the most dangerous country in the world. But I was so determined to do that story. It was at a time when Somalia was being billed as this place that looked like Mad Max. There was a lot of racism in the coverage. No one was interviewing Somalis. It was being described as a famine. It wasn't a famine. It was a man-made situation. And I really wanted to tell the story of the old dictatorship of Siad Barre and how we had supported this man, like the Soviets before us had supported him, and how Somalia was a terrible, tragic Cold War junkyard and sideshow, and how this place where money, millions of dollars have been pumped into this place in order to secure one base that was never ever used. It was Berbera, and it was only interesting to us because it was near the Saudi oil fields. It was never used, it was always a sideshow, and yet that money was used to buy weapons, used to buy bombs. There was a horrible case in 1988 when Hargeisa, a beautiful big Somali city, was flattened in order to stop a civil war. It was a horrifying dictatorship. And all of this led to those awful pictures in 1992. I wanted to tell that story.
Leslie Coburn, our guest. Her book, Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars and a Revolution. She's currently a producer at 60 Minutes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. And we're talking to Leslie Coburn, who is a longtime television documentary producer for ABC, for NBC, for CBS. Now she's a producer at 60 Minutes. And she's now written a book called Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. How did the network honchos treat you as a pregnant woman?
Well, the first time I tried it, back when I was working on that Liberia story, one of them completely went insane and said, how could you do that? He went to my superior and said, how can you possibly let this woman go out, you know, into this terrible situation pregnant? And fortunately, my superior said, well, you know, it's her decision. And, of course, it's like walking on eggshells for these guys. But fortunately, they didn't want to say no. And I found that so often in those big networks that if you push, if you really push hard, you can get what you're looking for. I think that sometimes women don't push hard enough. I think that you should have kids while you're working. What's the problem? It's more of a perception that, oh, if I have children, maybe I won't get a better job or I'll fall down on the career ladder or whatever. I mean, it was very important to me to do it all at once, which is possible to do.
Leslie Coburn, you were arrested as a spy in Gambia.
Yes.
How come? What were you doing there?
Well, it was a ridiculous situation. This was very early on in my career. I was, again, it was the early days at NBC in London, and my bureau chief asked me to go down to Africa to cover the first Roots tour in the Gambia. This was Alex Haley had written a book called Roots, which was about the whole story of African roots, and it was a wonderful novel and very popular. And so it was the first tour, and we went on the tour, and it was supposed to be just a very simple, light feature piece. And we were shooting it, but the Gambian government couldn't believe that we were there just to do this trivial piece. They thought we were there fomenting a coup. That's what they thought we were doing. So they hauled us in, interrogated us in very unpleasant, I mean, not too unpleasant. It wasn't as though we were tortured. We were simply deprived of water, coffee, cigarettes, you know, kept in these hot rooms for hours. And then they didn't want us to leave the country. So we figured that we had to flee, which we did, by getting two taxi drivers who were willing to, you know, you need a stamp to get out of the country, and we didn't have the stamp, and we couldn't fly out of the country. There were no planes flying. They were flying very infrequently. So we, in the dead of night, we raced across the northern border, and we only got across the border because one of the drivers of one of these taxi cabs, who we had given absolutely, you know, a year's salary to do this for us, was a cousin of one of the border guards. That's how we got across. It was a miracle.
Leslie Coburn is our guest, and we've covered a lot of ground, but we have so much more ground to cover. Looking for Trouble is her book, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. You march with the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia.
Well, that was for a Peter Jennings reporting documentary that we did in early 1990. It was What for me, it was one of the most important things in my career, because in 1989, there was a very good chance that the Khmer Rouge could come back to the capital. And to me, that was the most horrifying thing imaginable. So I began investigating this situation, and it turned out that the Khmer Rouge were in an alliance with something called the Non-Communist Resistance, forming this three-way guerrilla operation on the border of Thailand, and the United States was supplying them covertly with arms and money. And this, to me, was a really an absolute crime against humanity, because the Khmer Rouge, this is as though we were suddenly supplying Hitler so many years later. I mean, the Khmer Rouge had killed nearly 2 million people in Cambodia, yet there were no war crimes trials. Pol Pot was living in this very comfortable arrangement in southern Thailand, in Trat province. And somebody had to do something. So it was a tremendous opportunity doing this big hour with Jennings to go in and do that. And we went in on both sides of the war. We went in on the Thai border with the guerrillas, and we went on the other side. I got the Cambodian Minister of Defense to open up the West to journalists. It was closed off so that we could do that. And it was a monumental effort. And I took Jennings in on the border into Cambodia, into one of the most heavily mined areas in the world, to do this story. And we really caused a huge amount of trouble with it. After the film aired, there was an uproar on Capitol Hill. The people involved with the covert operation were hauled in for closed-door hearings. Baker went to President Bush and said, we must stop this support. Bush stopped it. And then the UN went into Cambodia, for better or for worse. But so it was a key. The film itself really was an important instrument of change at the time. Also, it was very gratifying because there were sanctions against Cambodia at the time, and Congress released millions of dollars for assistance for Cambodian children immediately after the film aired.
And yet you point out in your book that the position of the Bush White House was that the Khmer Rouge were a fact of life, and that in a sense the Khmer Rouge were really America's ally.
Oh, they were our ally. There was no question about it. We had the representative for Cambodia at the United Nations was Khmer Rouge. He had been a Khmer Rouge leader. This is the situation that I found so horrific, that we could just accept the fact that that these people were not only there, but we supported them because they were viewed at the time as a way to fight the Vietnamese in a kind of bitter aftermath of the Vietnam War. You know, Vietnam had gone into Cambodia. They took over Cambodia, pushing out the Khmer Rouge, who then went across, they ran across the border into Thailand and stayed in these border camps. And because the U.S. hatred of the Vietnamese was so intense, that even though the Vietnamese had done what was really could only be called a humanitarian act by getting these people out of Cambodia, when the Vietnamese withdrew, while they were still in Cambodia, the U.S. supported the Khmer Rouge, helped rearm them, get them going again on the border to fight the Vietnamese. And then when the Vietnamese left Cambodia in 1989, many of those same people kept saying, oh, they haven't left yet. They're still there. And therefore, the support for the Khmer Rouge continued.
The Iraq crisis that we have seen and will probably continue to see, what work have you done around Iraq and the Persian Gulf?
Well, immediately, I wrote about it in Looking for Trouble. I was in Saudi Arabia before the Gulf War. I was in Israel during the Scud attacks. And I spent the summer after the war in Iraq making a film called The War We Left Behind for PBS, for Frontline, which was about what had actually happened, what the consequences were of the bombing, and showing how the entire infrastructure of the country had been dismantled and the beginnings of the horror of the you know, terrible sort of devastation among the children of Iraq. Having done that, I then went back with my husband, Andrew. We did a piece for Vanity Fair looking at the whole, at the business interests of the people at the very top, and I spent time with Uday and Qusay Saddam Hussein, the sons, Qusay, who now runs the security services, looking at that very different side of Iraq. These are the guys who were pillaging Iraq. These are the people who couldn't care less about the baby in Basra Hospital, certainly not as much as I do, and how they were operating and breaking sanctions and black marketeering and making huge amounts of money. So I got blacklisted from Iraq for making that writing that piece.
And yet you also did work that angered the U.S. government around Iraq.
Well, that film, the Frontline film, was very controversial at the time. We were the only people who went back to Iraq to see what the bombing had done. And to me, this was incredible. I mean, here we had dropped 88,000 tons of bombs, 80,000 of which were dumb bombs. They were not laser-guided bombs. And no one else was asking the question, where did they land? We got this Nintendo war, and then no one was willing to do the after-action report. And that's what we did. And when we came back with the results, including we'd gone to pilots and gotten their own tapes from the cockpit. So we showed misses. Remember, everything was a direct hit during the war, and we showed the misses. And the film was very strong, and the Pope, in fact, demanded a copy. Because there was a very articulate aid worker from Catholic Relief who was in the film, and the Pope saw the film, and after that said that he believed that sanctions were inhumane, and the U.S. government was, you know, they reacted badly to the film because the film asked the question. We had the chief Pentagon targeteer on and showed that they had intentionally targeted the civilian infrastructure, which would obviously, with anyone with a brain, knows that that would lead to this horrific situation. When you don't have a sewage plant, you know what's going to happen.
And yet you have the coverage of the events leading up to a possible U.S. strike again against Iraq, and you have the journalists continually saying, that, you know, the Pentagon is saying they will only hit military targets, et cetera, as if there's no history, and we're not talking about ancient history, but 7 years ago.
That's right. I did a piece for 60 Minutes about, not exactly about that, but it was about, I did it last November, and it was about the whole business with anthrax, the weapons of mass destruction. I put on Saddam Hussein's former chief of military intelligence, Wafiq al-Samarahi, who was very interesting because he talked about the mentality on the inside of Saddam's regime and what would possibly make them use these weapons. He was there, for example, when the decision was taken to use chemical weapons on Halabja. So he was very much an insider. I wanted to look at both.
Halabja being the Kurdish village that
yes,
the Iraqis gassed.
Exactly. And I was interested to see whether it was anthrax was really a threat and whether it actually could be used as a weapon. Turns out that it's much harder to use it as a weapon than people described at the time. You can't just mix it in your bathtub and use it as a weapon. On the other hand, I believe from looking at poring over huge amounts of documents and talking to all the principals at UNSCOM and whatnot, that it is a serious problem. The only thing was that you can't bomb anthrax. You know, anthrax is kept in as dried spores, and you can move it around anywhere. You could put it in the basement of a school, or you could put it in a hotel lobby. And the idea that there would be some facility that you could easily bomb and destroy the stuff was clearly not the case. So what do you accomplish with your bombing? Do you go back again and hit the civilian infrastructure? I think that question was left unresolved. I mean, I'm so obviously so pleased that Kofi Annan was able to cool things down, at least for the time being, because I'm not convinced that the bombing, not only would it have killed a certain number of people, but it wouldn't have achieved anything.
There are many, I've talked to many Iraqis who think that Saddam Hussein is working together with Clinton.
Goes back a long way. They used to say that Saddam was was George Bush's best friend, which is how they said it. I think that, you know, clearly Saddam is not working with Clinton. I think that what they're reacting to is that argument that you'll hear, which says, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. Better keep Saddam in power than who knows what would happen after him. And to me, that's absolutely horrendous. I mean, let's let the Iraqis decide what they want to do. This is a dictatorship. It's very brutal. If you happen to be in the opposition, you're liable to have your tongue pulled out. It's a very brutal dictatorship. But to say that Saddam is somehow someone who would be better than his successor is, I just think, deeply unfair to the people who live there.
Did you also cover the U.S. and other international corporate interests that had supported Saddam through the years?
Yes, of course. I mean, Saddam, you know, when these things happened, like Halabja, for example, or the chemicals used in the Iran-Iraq War, no one complained. In fact, Saddam got his stock of anthrax from a company in Maryland. And there was a very close relationship between the United States and Iraq, a business relationship, which I think most people understand now, that he was only demonized after he went into Kuwait.
I mean, what's incredible is William Cohen, to this day, the Secretary of Defense, continually shows pictures of people who have been gassed and says, this is what this man did. But at the time, the U.S. knew it and was supporting Saddam Hussein.
That's right. I remember, you know, Peter Galbraith, who later became ambassador in Croatia, but he was an aide on the Hill, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he moved heaven and earth to get people to pay attention to Halabja. The people who knew about it and were pushing to get some response on it got very little response. So yes, these things were known about.
Well, as we wrap up, do you have hope for the future of news in this country, for the future of the corporate news media?
Yes, I do. I think that that the whole news business is very fluid, and I think that to say that it's just going down the tubes and we're not going to have any, you know, the stage is going to go black, I think is very pessimistic. I hear it all the time. But I think it really depends on, I mean, as I say, I'm teaching students now. I'm trying to encourage people to, and I think we should all be encouraging people to go into journalism, to do this work, to try and push and get stories on the air. You know, didn't we all read Tom Paine? I mean, there's something to be said for the Fourth Estate. I think that's our job. We have to keep pushing. If the stage goes black, then I'm sorry for all of us. But of course I have hope.
Leslie Coburn, thank you very much. Thank you for spending this time with us and for your book, Looking for Trouble, One Woman, Six Wars, and a Revolution. It's published by Anchor Books. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. Coming up on Democracy Now! This week, we'll be speaking with the brother of Mordechai Vanunu, imprisoned in solitary confinement in Israel for more than 12 years, just released into the general population. We'll also be looking at the USDA organic food standards. Last day of public comment is Thursday. Democracy Now! Produced by Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill, our technical director, Errol Maitland, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!